Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're glad you're with us today. It's been less than a week since Hurricane Michael made landfall as a Category 4 storm. More than 200,000 homes remain without power, and in many communities, few homes even remain standing. But for Americans living in the path of these hurricanes, the past few years have been devastating. There have been four Category 4 hurricanes in the past two storm seasons, from Harvey to Irma to Maria and now Michael. And that means some are still responding to one disaster when another one hits.
My name is Jody. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a nurse and I volunteer with the Red Cross. I was only home for 2 weeks from my deployment to Eastern North Carolina for Hurricane Florence when Hurricane Michael hit. I'm still participating in the relief efforts locally, coordinating nursing for shelters in my area for people who have lost power. After this winds down, I have been asked to return to Durham to work on Hurricane Florence again, and then I may try to go to Florida. It has been an exhausting couple of months.
As the disasters keep coming, so do the challenges of rebuilding. And climate experts say the storms are not going to let up. In fact, it's just the opposite. Today, we'll take a look at what hurricanes like Michael tell us about our own weaknesses, from building codes to community efforts. Craig Fugate was FEMA administrator from 2009 to 2017. He's seen the country through Hurricane Sandy and a host of other disasters. But before that, he was head of emergency management for the state of Florida. Craig, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Craig, one of the things that's become clear after Michael is we really need to assess building codes. Can you tell us why and how that is?
Well, probably the one storm that really showed Florida the need for better building codes and better enforcement was Hurricane Andrew. Tremendous damage, but in the aftermath, we saw that a lot of the construction wasn't even being built to the codes in the community. And so we learned that both the codes are important, but also the enforcement and inspection of those codes were critical.
And when you talk about storm surge as one of the biggest concerns, does that indicate in your experience that folks should not be thinking about building along the coast at this point?
Well, I think we have to be very careful about how we build along the coast. I think in many areas, particularly if you look at this part of Florida's coast, storm surge is measured in 10 feet and higher in many areas, and it goes well inland. So probably building right on the water's edge maybe not be the best place. But if we build appropriately, we elevate structures, it doesn't mean we cannot develop, but it means we're just not going to be able to build like we've done in the past. The other challenge we have with all this is not going to be inexpensive. In this part of the state, this is a lot of older Florida. Folks have lived here for generations. And as we talk about resiliency, I do have one concern, and that is as much as it's going to cost us to rebuild this coast, are we going to create a society of resilience based upon wealth and funding and displace people who can't afford that? Or are we going to look at how we can build resiliency in our coast and not leave out the working class?
I think that's really the big question. We seem to see this happening over and over again in many of the storms that hit us. I'm thinking about Katrina. I'm thinking about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Thinking obviously about now in Michael. The economic differences really stand out. Are there structural issues after these storms that stand out to you in terms of, particularly when we look at lower income communities?
Yeah, the one that really sticks out in the front end is the insurance and lack of it, particularly flood insurance, but also because wind insurance is very expensive in Florida. Many times people have high deductibles for that wind damage. It's not uncommon for people who own their homes, have lived there for generations, who cannot afford to repair their homes or bring them up to code because their insurance isn't there or isn't covering the losses. And most of our federal programs aren't really designed in mind of how do we make sure, and again, you know, I'm not just talking about low income. I'm talking about people that work, you know, nurses, paramedics, firefighters, sheriff's deputies, police officers, school teachers, people that work down at the local, you know, hardware store. These are, you know, essential workforce for these communities. Yet in many cases along the beaches and these coastal communities where they live, they're being priced out as the cost of rebuilding is so high but also as investors see opportunity to go in and develop these areas.
Well, we saw a lot of that in Miami, actually. Our team was down reporting there earlier this summer, and we saw that there were places that were essentially gentrifying as people were moving inland to try and, live places where they weren't going to be affected by hurricanes.
Yeah, and throughout the state of Florida, particularly in the 04 and 05 hurricanes, I saw this tendency that we were displacing the working class, we were displacing the poor in the name of new development that was oftentimes being built on top of areas that had been devastated in the previous hurricanes.
Craig Fugate is former FEMA administrator and former head of emergency management for the state of Florida. Craig, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's turn now to the future. How can we design communities to be more resilient in the face of climate change? Here to help us figure this out is Thad Miller, a professor at the School for Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State University. Thanks for joining us, Thad.
Thank you for having me.
So, Thad, we hear this word resilience lobbed around left and right when we're talking about building our cities. What are we talking about? What does that actually mean?
Right. That's a great question, one that cities are grappling with right now. And I think there's a tendency to focus on the hard infrastructure when we think about resilience. And it is that. But it's also about how our environmental systems are positioned. For example, wetlands that had been eroded before Katrina came actually contributed to a worse storm. But it's also our social systems. So that means both the ability of communities to bounce back and to come together before, during, and after an event. But it's also how our organizations are able to create more resilient communities and infrastructure and respond to those events.
And when we think about infrastructure, I mean, with our previous guests, we talked a little bit about these, the Category 4 storms. We've had four in the past couple of storm seasons. We're seeing lots of damage to infrastructure and lots of attempts at building back. Should we be trying to build things that will withstand anything and everything that nature will throw at us? Or are you seeing resilience as something that, perhaps might fail and be able to bounce back more quickly?
Right. I think, that will depend on where you are and community needs. And then I think it'll end up being both strategies. There may be infrastructure in place that you just have to say, we cannot move this power plant right now, or at least not for the next 30 years. So we have to make sure that nuclear system, for example, is protected. But there may be other examples where after a storm, it does make more sense to give more room to the river or to give more room to the shoreline. And you see that happening in places from Staten Island in New York City all the way to the Columbia River and discussions with cattle farmers about how do we let this flood but then compensate you if it does.
And one of the things that comes up often when we're talking about disaster recovery is cost. You mentioned Staten Island here in New York. There are still some folks who are trying to recover from Hurricane Sandy, which feels like it was eons ago. Obviously, we're looking, we see folks dealing with Michael and dealing with Hurricane Maria. Who is supposed to pay for this type of resilience? Who do you see as responsible for the long-term recovery of these places? And where does the burden really fall here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not sure that I have the perfect answer other than to say I think it's all hands on deck. I know New York after Sandy has been lucky in the sense that they've been able to bring both local funding for that, but also federal funding. But other cities who maybe haven't had a recent disaster, right, and then therefore don't have the attention or maybe the access to the federal funding for recovery that a New York or others might have, are still trying to think about how to fund this so that we're resilient in advance of an event, and so that they don't have the next Sandy happen to them, for example. And so that is about what our local organizations and local taxpayers willing to bear to prepare for weather and climate.
Well, I think that's the big question, because when we think about this, I often think, what should we you know, about resilience. I mean, is it a question that we have to ask ourselves even more difficult questions about where we decide to build at all? I'm thinking about the coastlines. I'm thinking about places that are much more likely to be affected. Should taxpayers be, you know, dealing with that burden if they themselves aren't the ones who are building in these more precarious areas? Like, who does the burden really fall on at that point? If I decide, if my home is destroyed and then I decide to build it back, you know, aren't I taking the risk of having it destroyed again?
Right, exactly. And in some cases, maybe it is that those shoreline properties that are wealthier neighborhoods, as you were talking with your previous guest. But in other cases, it may be communities that don't really have the resources to recover or to build back because that neighborhood was known as a low-lying inland flooding neighborhood and no one else wanted to live there. And so it became a lower income area. And so I think it depends. And you pointed out with your previous guest as well that the insurance system is a big part of this. And I think there's going to have to be discussions between, you know, federal and local levels and insurance companies about how to best create a system that is resilient, right? It's not just the hard infrastructure that needs to be resilient, but it's also these other systems, including insurance and economic systems that need to go into this as well.
Right. And also city planning. I'm thinking, you know, a lot of these cities that a lot of the places we live in, as you mentioned, initially probably were not dealing with these forces like they're dealing with now. What do you think it would take to actually climate proof our communities? Is that even possible? I mean, I know we're reporting on the fact that in the next couple of decades, if we don't do something soon, we're in a bad situation here climate wise.
For sure. Yeah. And I think the key point there is that it's not that planners and engineers haven't thought about climate and weather. It's just that the climate and weather that they've built into infrastructure over the past 50 plus years, that knowledge is now outdated and it's built for climate and weather patterns that really no longer exist. Yet the stormwater pipes that you put in the ground 50 or 75 years ago still have to function now with a different climate. And I think planners, engineers, et cetera, at the city level are increasingly realizing this. And it's a real issue whether they're going to be tackling with it under something called resilience or an office of resilience, or they're just thinking together about and noticing the changes in weather patterns and how to more effectively deal with this, knowing that the future is not going to be like the past.
Thad, briefly, do you see any hope here? I'm thinking of the subways in New York City now that when it rains, it almost rains underground at this point because our infrastructure is so broken.
Right. I mean, I do see some hope that maybe that's more my personality, but I think cities increasingly see this as fundamental, and cities and communities want their infrastructure to work so they can be economically competitive, healthy, vibrant places. I think cities see this as something that is, about their fundamental sustainability moving forward.
Thad Miller is a professor at the School for the Future of Innovation and Society at Arizona State University, and he co-leads the Urban Resilience Sustainability Research Network, which is funded by the National Science Foundation.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.